I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In a lot of ways, Craig Johnson resembles the character he's written about for more than a decade. Both men have a thing for denim, cowboy hats, beat-up old trucks, and Johnson lives in a tiny Wyoming town, and I mean tiny. Today we'll meet the best-selling author whose Walt Longmire books have been turned into a six-season hit series for Netflix. Then you'd expect the director of an historical society to have a big history collection, but Steve and Marianne Knowles is so large they bought a neighboring home to put it all in. We'll speak to them about their ever-expanding assemblage. After that, Brian McTavish presents the Weekend To-Do List. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Author Craig Johnson is out with the 13th novel in his long-running and best-selling Longmire series, which forms the basis for the hit drama Longmire that returns to Netflix this fall for its sixth and final season. This latest book, The Western Star, centers on Sheriff Walt Longmire, an old photograph of 25 armed men, an excursion train known as the Western Star, and an upcoming parole hearing for one of the most dangerous men Walt has ever encountered in a lifetime of law enforcement. Craig Johnson is in Kansas City today in the midst of a grueling 21-city book tour, and he'll speak in town tonight. And, Craig, what a pleasure to have you here. Welcome.
Know, Steve, you talk like it's real work. It's not. Like, I've had real jobs before, and this is nothing at
this
all
like
that.
This is not like
no,
that.
Not at all.
Being squired around different towns all over. Well, you're channeling Agatha Christie here in this whodunit. You're clearly an admirer of hers.
Oh, I am. I think any time that you're going to, you know, toil in somebody else's field, you kind of have to give them a little bit of the credibility there, like a little bit of the kudos. Like it. And so whenever I came up with the idea of these, you know, 25 armed men on a train like that, I thought, you know what, probably you need to give a nod to Dame Agatha. Like that. And so, of course, one of the things that happens is when Walt is climbing on board the train, like that, he's stopped in at the newsstand to get a roll of Reed's candies, I think, in a paperback. And it happens to fall out of his back pocket as he's climbing on the train. And the other sheriff's walking up behind him, picks it up, and it's Agatha Christie's Murder on the Orient Express. And he looks at Walt and says, "Are you studying up?" And he, Walt goes, "No, no, no." Like, and he goes, "Well, she had it figured out, didn't she?" And Walt goes, "What do you mean?" She says, "Well, you know, he did it, she did it, they all did it, nobody did it." You know? And he says, "She pretty much covered all the bases there." Like, and he says, "You know what, have you read that book yet, youngster?" And Walt says, "No, sir, I haven't." And he goes, "Well, we'll talk when you're done."
we'll explain it all then. Well, tell us about this new book, The Western Star, and the photograph of the 25 armed men standing in front of a northern steam locomotive, the Wyoming Sheriff's Association junket he once went on aboard the Western Star, this upcoming parole hearing for one of the most dangerous men that Walt has ever encountered.
Well,
it's quite a plot.
It's kind of like, you know, one of those, I tend to refer to it as riding Roman. You remember the old rodeo racks, you know, where somebody would come into the arena and they'd have like one boot on, you know, a different horse saddle, you know, so you got, basically you're riding two horses at once, you know. Like, it's kind of the same thing with the narrative on a book like this, you know, where you have two stories that you're trying to tell simultaneously. Like, and, you know, and it was kind of interesting. It's something I'd done before, but this was a little bit of fun like that because it reveals so much about Walt's past back in 1972 when this first opportunity came, when he got back from Vietnam and had just been hired by Lucian Conley, like getting taken on this junket train like across Wyoming for one weekend with all these other sheriffs. So he's the only deputy in a train full of sheriffs, like that. And as one of his cohorts, you know, Joe Ironcloud says, 24 armed sheriffs on a train. And Walt looks at him and says, "When we started."
Yeah. Well, tell us a little more about Walt Longmire. And he's not a superhero. For people who aren't familiar with him, tell us who he is.
You know, Walt is, well, you know, first of all, he's like the sheriff of the least populated county in the least populated state in America, where, you know, Wyoming, we have only like, you know, about 500,000 people in the whole state. I mean, you know, the town that's the closest to my ranch where I live only has a population of 25, you know, 23 today because my wife and I are here at the studio. But it's, you know, it's one of those things where I was kind of looking for something kind of anti-CSI. I was looking for something that was going to be, you know, going in a different direction like that. And so Walt was kind of emblematic of that. And the term that I tend to use for him is over. He's overweight, he's overage, he's overly depressed, you know, but he still gets up in the morning and tries to do the job.
Mm-hmm. Why have you stuck with him so long?
You know, he's actually good company. I think I stumbled onto something there, I think, you know, very early on, you know, when I was trying to come up with this composite of this character. And, you know, he's got some really wonderful qualities, too. And the number one one being that he's decent. You know, he's kind-hearted, he's good, he's intelligent, he's funny, he's smart, he's well-read, which is maybe something that I didn't take into consideration when I was thinking about his, you know, connections with the reading public. They've kind of taken him to heart. I mean, this is our 9th book on the New York Times bestsellers list. We're number 7 this week.
Wow, good for you. Congratulations.
And yeah. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that, you know, that Walt is decent. You know, he's a good guy. He's got a code that he lives by. Whenever the producers were, you know, looking to, you know, do the television show with Warner Brothers, you know, they asked me a lot of questions, and I kind of did the reverse interview thing and asked them a couple of questions, and I said, why Walt? I mean, there are 240 mysteries, you know, produced every month. You know, why did you choose my character? And I remember, you know, Greer Shepherd, the head producer, she said, well, you know, Craig, since the 60s, we've had this kind of anti-hero thing going on, and it's kind of hyper-accelerated here in the last, you know, decade or so, to where you can't tell the good guys from the bad guys almost. Huh. And she said, you know, the thing about Walt is he's kind of a, you know, true blue, honest-to-goodness hero like that, and he's a good guy, like, and he's going to do the right thing, and we think that that'll, you know, ring. It'll have a resonance with people, and by golly, they were right.
Hey, tell us about the day that your agent or your email box, you see a note and suddenly you find out that Netflix is interested in your project here. That must have been a moment for you.
Oh, it was. I get it. But it was also interesting, too, because, I mean, for years, you know, people would get their books signed, and the first thing they would say to me was, you know, well, okay, well, when they make a TV show or a movie out of your books, and I would laugh. Mm-hmm. I would laugh, Steve, because I thought, you know, I'm writing a series of books, you know, that have gotten published about the least populated county sheriff, you know, in America. I think I've used up my quota of miracles. I don't think that anything else is going to happen, and that's going to be okay.
Right.
But yeah, it was really kind of wonderful. We did this little courting dance, you know, with Hollywood there for a couple of years, like that. And then what happened was Warner Brothers came in with a package deal, you know, with the producers and the directors and the writers and everybody all kind of contained and involved in the process, like that. And it was pretty amazing, like that. I mean, I've got to admit, I didn't really believe it was going to happen until I finally, you know, actually what happened was we actually got a box of DVDs of the auditions for the actors that they were looking at for Walt Longmire. And Robert Taylor, like that, who actually got the role, he's actually on the cover of Cowboys and Indians magazine this month.
Wow.
And he did a fantastic interview, like, and did a wonderful audition, like that. And my wife was sitting behind me as we were watching the DVD there at the ranch, and her immediate response was, he's handsome. And then she dug her hole a little bit deeper and said, you know, he's kind of like a TV version of you, taller, better looking, with a better voice.
Yeah.
So I'm not as big of a fan of Robert Taylor as I used to be.
Well, did you have some say in the choice of Robert Taylor?
I actually did. Like, I mean,
no,
generally,
kidding.
You know, in those kind of situations, you know, Hollywood, the first thing they want to do is get the novelist out of there and out of the way as fast
sure,
as possible, so that they can, you know, move on.
Because you get in the way.
Yeah. I'm liable to do what a lot of authors have want to do, which is, like, you know, argue with them about things like, you know, my character would never wear a green shirt, or it never rains on Thursday, or something really important like that. You know, because you hear a lot of those stories about, you know, a lot of authors who've had, like, really bad experiences with Hollywood, and I kind of put blame on both sides, you know, an awful lot of the time. But yeah, they had kept me in the loop. They sent me the DVDs of the auditions for the actors that they were looking at, and not that I had final say or anything like that, but every single one that I really wanted were the ones who actually got the roles.
Including Lou Diamond Phillips.
Including Lou Diamond Phillips, yeah.
Yeah. What was it like for you seeing this thing come to life? Because clearly you have your own vision, and then other people suddenly have their visions. I mean, what was that? Was it fun? Was it painful? Was it both? What was it?
The only way I can describe it is it's kind of like having a house plant in your house for 7 or 8 years and then getting up one morning and having it start talking to you. That's what it's like. Like, it's really kind of bizarre. It's wonderful, but kind of weird, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, but yeah, it was all, you know, really kind of a steep learning curve, like, for me. But I think at a certain point in time, what you have to do is kind of go in with your eyes open and say to yourself, okay, you know, books are one thing, but television and movies are something else. Like, and the best thing you can do in those situations, of course, is to try and get in with the best people that you can possibly work with, and then do the hardest thing in the world, Mm-hmm. Leave them alone. Mm-hmm. Let them do what they do best. And, you know, and these were producers that were responsible for Saving Grace, Nip Tuck, you know, all of these.
So they knew what
shows.
They were doing.
Yeah, they knew what they were doing. Much more so than a cowboy from a town of 25, I can tell you that much. Mm-hmm. So.
Did what they, how they portrayed your vision, did it change how you thought about Walt and the other characters or not?
Not really like that, because I had already been writing the books for about 7 or 8 years.
They were pretty well set.
Yeah, before they'd come along. And one of my favorite quotes is the one from Wallace Stegner, where he says, you know, that the greatest piece of fiction ever written is the disclaimer at the beginning of every book that says nobody in this book is based off anybody alive or dead. You know, what a crock that is, because that's your job, to go find interesting people. Like, and so the majority of the people that are in my books actually have a basis in friends and family and neighbors and people I've worked with. And it would be really, really difficult for the actors to transplant, you know, like my father. I remember my brother calling me up when he read The Cold Dish, the first book in the Walt Longmire series, and said, Craig, the old sheriff that Walt goes and plays chess with on Tuesday nights, Lucian Connolly, that's our dad. I was like, I thought I hid that really well. Like, and he goes, no, he looks like dad, he acts like dad, he talks like dad. The only thing you did was cut off one of his legs, and I don't think it's going to fool dad. So,
well, is Sheriff Walt Longmire, to what extent is he you? Is he Craig Johnson?
You know, the one who has the best statement about that is my wife, Judy. And she says that Walt Longmire is who Craig would like to be in 10 years. It's just he's off to an incredibly slow start.
Is that true?
Yeah, it is. Like, I mean, I think, you know, one of the big differences between Walt and I is I have not had the kind of tragedy that Walt has had in his life. You know, I mean, his wife died, you know, 5 years previous, you know, when the first book starts up. And he's had a lot of difficulties, and he deals with a lot of things on a day-to-day basis that are, you know, that have consequences. I mean, these were jobs, you know, obviously that you have effects on people's lives and large-scale consequences. I mean, you know, what I do is fly around, you know, and check into hotels, you know, eat in restaurants, and, you know, march into libraries and bookstores where there are like hundreds of people who are really happy to see me and talk about my work. And, you know, like we were discussing before, I don't know what the bad part about that is, you know, so I haven't been quite as tested, I think, as Walt has been.
I was going to say, in just reading about you last night, this year, 14,000 fans flooded into the town of Buffalo, Wyoming. Population 4,600, by the way, so three times the population of Buffalo, Wyoming, for Longmire Days. And you're there. What do you make of that? It's got to be just a huge kick for you.
Well, it's more like an unnatural disaster is what it's like because all the restaurants and grocery stores run out of food. All of the banks and ATM machines run out of money. And everybody walks around with their cell phones looking at the little blue circle of death because they've overrun the amount of cell bandwidth that there is for the one little tower in Buffalo, Wyoming. And, you know, but it's really kind of a wonderful event. Like, it's simply because, you know, all the actors come up to this tiny town in Buffalo because they filmed the TV show down in Santa Fe, down in New Mexico, mostly, you know, a number of different reasons, but one of the reasons being they start filming in February, and anybody that's ever been to up on the Wyoming-Montana border in February knows that unless you want it to look like Nome, Alaska, you're probably going to have to head south. And so, you know, it's a nice opportunity for them at the end of every production season, like, to actually come up and be in Wyoming for a week or so. And it's really kind of wonderful like that because all these people show up, you know, but it's also, it was a little tricky at first because I started thinking about it and I thought, okay, bringing these people up to my home, you know, in Johnson County, Wyoming, like, it's kind of like bringing a girl home to meet your mother. You know, you got to make sure that they're, you know, going to be on their best behavior. Like, and to be honest, you know, I needn't have worried like that because they are just so gracious and so approachable and such an incredible group like that. I needn't have worried at all.
Well, the fact that your writings have stimulated that much interest in the books and obviously the Netflix series doesn't hurt any. Again, that's just got to be a thrill.
Oh, it is. It is. And I mean, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, I mean, if it was just, you know, gratuitous, you know, sex and violence or something like that, I guess maybe I wouldn't feel as good about it like that. But I just, one of the things I feel very strongly about is the decent aspect, I think, that Walt kind of brings across like that. You know, and that's a term I think that's like, you know, not used as much in society as maybe it should be. You remember we were all brought up to be decent, you know, to be kind to each other and look out for each other, you know, and all of those things like that. And I think that Walt kind of embodies, you know, to a certain extent, you know, a lot of the Western values that, you know, that are, you know, kind of been lost to a certain extent.
Is that the appeal, do you think, at the end of the day? There's something real and honest, and it's a little bit of a throwback, and people yearn for that kind of authenticity, you know, in modern day life, which a lot of folks think is completely lacking?
I think so. Look, at, I think, you know, well, the books have been translated into about 17 languages, too.
Wow.
Look at,
wow.
And so, and, you know, and some surprisingly, you know, I mean, if somebody would have told me that the books were going to be a runaway hit in a foreign country, maybe France wouldn't have been the first guess that I would have made like that. Mm-hmm. But they're, you know, a really big hit in France. Like, and I've asked, you know, a lot of my translators.
Yeah, what's that about? Yeah.
Well, and I've asked the translators, I've asked, you know, the foreign publishers and stuff, and you know what the appeal is for them, like that, because of that might give me a different perspective, you know, on, you know, the appeal of the books and certainly the television show. And consistently what they had to say was is that there were a lot of different things that take into consideration. One was, of course, the appeal of, you know, the epic romantic American West. I mean, there's always going to be that, you know, kind of like soul searching lust, you know, to go and longing to go out into open space and all of that. And I think that, you know, that has a lot to do with it, but I think probably the characters more than anything else, the complexities of character,
yeah.
And the fact that, you know, that Walt is kind of a stand-up guy like that, that he yeah. does, you know, look out. I mean, one of the things I would get, you know, out of a lot of Wyoming and Montana sheriffs whenever I was in, you know, interviewing them and talking with them before I was getting ready to write the books was there was a term they used, my people.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I think is that, you know, sheriffing is a very specific style of law enforcement in the sense that it's the only elected law enforcement official in the United States. And so at that point, what you do is you become actually connected to, you know, your citizenry like that. Mm-hmm. And they feel, you know, very strongly that since they gave you their vote, that you are responsible to them for their problems and the difficulties that they face in their life. And I think that makes you a lot more approachable than, say, somebody in a cruiser with a pair of chrome sunglasses on.
Yeah.
You know, it
yeah.
just you're there. And you've got an office, and they can come and knock on it anytime they want.
Craig Johnson is my guest. He's the author of the best-selling and long-running series, the Longmire series. It's a series on Netflix. His latest book, The Western Star, he'll be appearing at 7 tonight at a Rainy Day Books author event at the Mid-Continent Public Library. That's the Woodneath Library Center, 8900 Northeast Flintlock Road in Kansas City. More information, go to rainydaybooks.com. That's 7 o'clock tonight. And I'll put that out again in just a few minutes. If you want to join our conversation with Craig, 816-235-2888. Call real quick. We just have a few minutes left with him. 816-235-2888. Or you can tweet us at KCUR.org. You know, do you find yourself sort of still drawn to the open spaces yourself? Because you live out there in little U Cross, Wyoming.
Mm-hmm.
You get out and walk it, and do you work the ranch, or are you just too busy writing?
Oh, no, absolutely. Like, I mean, that's what's really kind of nice about my life right now is it's kind of a balance, you know, between a ranching life like and a writing life, you know, because whenever I get tired of that intellectual life, I can go out and work on the ranch. Like, and if I ever get tired of the physical stuff, I can go inside and start writing again. But for me, that's one of the great joys. Like, and the difficulty, of course, is that if you live, you know, in the American West, sometimes you can take it for granted. Sometimes, you know, you just forget that it's there. And there are wonderful moments that kind of bring it all back to me. Like, I mean, whenever I look up, you know, at the Bighorn Mountains and that Cloud Peak Wilderness area and suddenly see those 14,000 foot, you know, snow, you know, capped mountains, which, you know, they just got snow on them again here just this last week. Or, you know, I'm feeding the horses and I come outside and I look up, you know, and I see that big, thick part of the Milky Way galaxy that stretches as a big arch, you know, from one horizon to the other, and what the Northern Cheyenne and the Crow referred to as the Hanging Road, it just kind of stalls me out. Like, I'm just going to have to stand there for a few moments to soak it in.
Well, you can't be spending too much time on ranching work because, Craig, you're kicking out a book a year here, and I was wondering how you're managing that because that's got to be some pressure involved in that.
You know, it's really not. I got to admit that if I didn't have at least a book to put out a year, I'd probably be driving myself crazy.
Is that right?
Yeah. I just, you know, I really enjoy the writing. I love the writing. That's my number one enjoyment, you know, in the whole process. It's like, you know, sitting down in a room by myself and, you know, and typing about my imaginary friends, like, and seeing what's going to happen and where they're going to go and what's going to be going on in their lives like that. And then, you know, the second one, of course, is, you know, the travel part. I really enjoy going out and actually getting to meet, you know, the people that read my books. I mean, I'm always thinking about all of those authors that never got the opportunity, that never had the chance, you know, to go out and meet the people that, you know, that read their books. And for me, it's just, it's an honor to be able to do it.
I was going to say, you know, you have a chance to meet those people. You meet people you're interviewing to get information for the books. Do you have the book and do you have the plot in mind before you launch into the writing? You got to be there, right?
Absolutely.
Is that the hard part of what you do?
No, not really. Like, I mean, you know, because I've got so many backed up. I mean, when I wrote the first book, The Cold Dish, like, which is the first book in the Walt Longmire series, like, Viking Penguin sat me down and said, you know, we'd like for you to do this as a series, you know, and that's when I, with the knowledge of not even having had one book published, started arguing with the president of Penguin USA and going, I don't think that's a good idea, but I got some other ideas I want to bounce off of you. And she said, why don't you go home and think about this? And so I did look at, and it worried me, you know, to think about writing, you know, a series, because I thought, okay, I don't want to get stuck in a rut. I don't want to, you know, become formalized, you know, with my writing or anything. And so I kind of, you know, made a vow to myself that that would not be the case. Look at, and so I have been collecting information, you know, on all of the different storylines that I've got, like that. And I got to be honest, Steve, I'm going to die before I get them all written is what's going to happen. Yeah.
Because most people are struggling to find what the next book might be about, and you've already got it figured out.
No, I've got, I'm backed up with them. So, I mean, I've got file folders that are stacked up about 3 feet high right beside my writing desk.
Life's too good, Craig.
It is.
Congratulations. It is. Yeah, that's great. Again, you can see and hear Craig Johnson this evening at 7 at a Rainy Day Books author event at the Mid-Continent Public Library. That's at the Woodneath Library Center, 8900 Northeast Flintlock Road. And this is the music that you write to sometimes,
it is.
Right?
This is Philip Auberg out of Montana, who is an absolutely magnificent pianist. And it's actually mentioned in the acknowledgments of my book. And I am so surprised and pleased that you guys have this
song. And you love the way this song builds to a climax towards the end. It's all solo piano, but it works for you.
It does. It does. And Walt, you know, he actually does play the piano. And whenever I imagine Walt playing the piano, this is what I hear.
This is what it sounds like. Yeah. Craig, what a pleasure to have you.
My pleasure.
All the best to you.
Thank you, sir.
Welcome back to the second half of Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we broadcast live from Lenexa's new Civic Center and learned how the development is helping local entrepreneurs. You can find that conversation at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, we speak with hit singer-songwriter and Leavenworth native Melissa Etheridge. Also, we discuss the legacy of Kansas City educator, philanthropist, and businesswoman Marjorie Powell Allen. That's on tomorrow's Up to Date here on KCUR. Well, Steve and Marianne Noel are into history, and that's putting it mildly. They don't just read about it, they collect it, and their focus is on Kansas City history. So much so that the Prairie Village couple bought the home next door to house their historical collection, which includes postcards and books and maps and decanters and souvenirs from the opening of Union Station, the former Hotel Baltimore, and the Kansas City Zoo, and just about anything else. Why are they all so into this? We're about to find out. Steve Knowles, executive director of the Jackson County Historical Society, which begins to explain all this. He plans to retire at year's end. And Steve, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Marianne Knowles also here. She dreams of opening a museum one day to display all of these artifacts. And Marianne, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you two actually bought the house next door. I mean, just curious, what do people have to say about that, Steve?
Well, they think it's a little eccentric, I think.
Is it?
So it started pretty innocently. It was a rental house and had been for more than a decade. And the resident, the occupants, the renters were moving out, and we had been really wondering what we could do with some of this stuff. And the owner lives out of state, and we knew they were happy to be shed of it, so we worked out a deal really quickly. It was a little awkward in that we had one phone conversation. Everything else was by email. And along the way, it was kind of an interesting turn of events. We don't hear from the seller at any point, and I'm buying some furniture down in the West Bottoms that'll fit in perfectly. Marianne's saying, you can't put furniture in that house. You don't own it. But we have an understanding. it was a classic turn of events where at the title company that the seller had selected, half the documents were on one desk, the other half were on another desk.
Wow.
So we were finally able to get everything pulled together.
Well, Marianne, my sense was you guys were simply out of room in your original house and you needed some more space to house all your artifacts here.
That is exactly what happened. He keeps bringing things home, and I let him fill the basement, and I let him fill the garage, and then he filled his office, and then it started to creep out.
Yeah.
And that's what I would say. The creep is happening. You need to get this under control. And so this solution worked out well.
I was going to say, how tight were things getting in your house with all this stuff?
Well, you couldn't go upstairs unless you lived there because there was stuff everywhere.
Wow.
We would have been thought of as hoarders, maybe.
You know, Steve, my sense here is that you're the ringleader when it comes to the drive to collect. Am I right about that?
I guess I have to admit to that.
Yeah. Okay. And how has that worked for you, Marianne?
Well,
or have you had any choice?
I haven't had a lot of choice, but I'm an enabler. It's fun to go look for these things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exciting when you find something you haven't ever seen before or something you've looked for a long time.
So what are you looking for when you're out there? What's going to trip your trigger? What's going to trip the trigger of your husband here?
Well, I think we both really like the hospitality part of Kansas City,
mm-hmm.
hotels, restaurants. I went to an estate sale one day, and I went down to the basement, and there was a whole stack of menus. And I was so excited, I could hardly dial the phone fast enough to call him and say, guess what I found?
No kidding.
It was truly a treasure trove.
Yeah. Why the hospitality industry, Steve? What grabs you about it?
Well, I've always been interested in that. I worked briefly as a part-time bartender for a place on the plaza called Fred Piatt's.
Sure.
And that was Gilbert Robinson, and they had perfected the casual dining and the multiple concepts. And that's what really gave me some insights into it. But, you know, hotels, restaurants, nightclubs, people go to celebrate, to mourn, to really just act out their human emotions in sometimes alone, sometimes with the groups, the family.
Yeah,
and it changes constantly.
Mm-hmm.
The restaurants have to reinvent themselves every few years, or they get stale and they're overtaken by somebody else. But it captures the essence of any given decade or era.
How much interest is there out there in the public, Marianne, in terms of what you've got?
Well, everybody who comes to visit is, I think, blown away. They just are like, wow. And there's a lot of reminiscing that goes on.
Mm-hmm.
We had a group from CCVI last week.
And people call you up and say, we want to come over and see it?
We have had a little bit of that. It's mostly people we know.
Yeah.
Or there'll be one person we know, and they'll say, can I bring my group?
Right.
But they were reminiscing about, oh, I remember that hotel.
Yeah.
I stayed there when I was a kid, or that's where we got married. Or
mm-hmm.
And it's fun to hear those stories.
Mm-hmm.
And down the basement for, 40-plus years, I've collected matchbooks, and I have, 7 or 8 big display boards, and it's all hospitality industry.
Mm-hmm.
And people are just drawn to that. Number one, matchbooks are a bygone phenomenon
right.
in and of themselves.
Right.
But when people see those logos, those names, they immediately start relating a story of one time when they were there and what happened.
You began collecting when you were a kid, right, Steve?
It was pretty innocuous level at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I have the little wooden pirate ship off my 5th birthday cake, and but it actually came from a Wolferman's, so there's a historical context. It just sort of started young and the last 20 years or so.
Is it an obsession, or is it just simply a hobby you enjoy and it's kind of under control?
Well, that's a very subjective question.
Well, I know.
It's under control because now I'm much more selective,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes now we'll find an artifact that I know we already have it, but this one's in better condition.
Right.
I've actually donated stuff that to charity auctions, the Jackson County Historical Society's annual dinner.
Right.
So we do pass some of it along.
Do you ever have a conflict with the Historical Society? Are you and the Society ever competing for the same piece?
No, because historical societies and archives in general tend to focus on two-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
It's the maps, the pictures, letters, diaries. Whereas then there's incredible historic value in those. But to me, these artifacts really are what people have seen, they've experienced. Maybe they bought one. Maybe mm-hmm. they bought one and lost it somewhere along the way. So, no, not really. And there are times when I find things that don't really fit into any of ours that I actually give to the Historical Society.
Marianne, what's the coolest thing you've got in this collection, at least based on your point of view?
Steve, maybe 3 or 4 months ago, found on an online auction two lamps that were in the Tiffin Room in Wolferman's downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And they are gorgeous lamps. They look great on the mantle in the history house, we call it.
Right.
I really want to take them to my house mm-hmm. and put them on the mantle there because I just love them. And
Very Art Deco.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the stories that they could tell, if they could tell about the people who sat at that table and what the conversations were. I think that's part of the fun for me.
Steve, what's the prized piece as far as you're concerned?
Probably some of the Priests of Pallas, which was a civic festival, late 19th century.
Wow.
As part of a week-long and grew multiple weeks at one point, they would have a masked ball, a high society ball, and the public would actually buy tickets to sit in the balcony at the convention hall downtown and watch the guests have the experience their evening. But if you attended the ball, you received a souvenir.
Mm-hmm.
And usually it was pot metal. It has very little intrinsic value other than you got it for attending.
Huh.
And there's many collectors around the country who actually – and that's really one of the few aspects of that era that are still remaining.
Is there something you're just dying to get your hands on that you know is out there somewhere but you can't quite get it?
You mean what is the Holy Grail?
Yes, maybe – yeah, sure.
Well, you know, I didn't know that the Wolferman table lamps would be, but they briefly passed through that slot. There was a Gilbert Robinson restaurant called Sam Wilson's. It was mid-American meat and potatoes menu. But I understand that their original menus were actually painted on a meat cleaver. And it kind of like the wine bottles that they used for the leather bottle and earlier the Inn at the Landing. So that's and I've never seen one, but
you'd like to
but
see
people
one.
Have told me they're out there.
Well, if our listeners know of that, you can get a hold of the Knowles here. Well, you brought some cool things with you. Let's talk about some of these things. And Steve, you just alluded to the leather wrap bottle menu from the leather bottle restaurant. You're holding it now in your hand. Describe it to us.
Well, the leather bottle was a restaurant. It was originally opened as the Inn at the Landing. Phenomenal concept, exciting, strikingly different from anything else in town. At the new suburban shopping center at 63rd and Troost, the Landing.
Mm-hmm.
And very successful, really launched the Gilbert Robinson era. But when they wanted to roll it out to different markets, you couldn't really call those other restaurants in other cities the Inn at the Landing because it wouldn't be at the Landing Shopping Center. So they changed the name to the Leather Bottle. And this is a wine bottle wrapped in leather where the menu is actually lettered on by hand. The waiter, the server would actually bring this to the table, present it to you. Kansas City sirloin, $6.50. Filet mignon, still $6.50.
Wow.
But includes all
I'll
the
take
salad
one.
You
take
can
it right
build.
Now. Yeah.
And they would have these little hang tags that they would change each day. How about escargot for $2?
Not bad.
So that's an example of there's some of them still out there. Whenever a restaurant or hotel closes, usually they sell off all the furnishings or certainly whatever specific
and
to
that's
them.
When you like the pounds.
Well, that yeah. And The Hotel Baltimore, which was downtown, closed in 1938. It was Kansas City's most elegant, finest hotel. When it closed, they auctioned everything off, and then they demolished it the following year. Hmm. And there are collectors that their whole collection is focused on the Hotel Baltimore.
No kidding. And people who just focus strictly on the Hotel Baltimore?
Yes. And in fact, there was an 8x10 black and white on eBay. So this was a newspaper photo. It probably came from the Star Times. And it was a shot of the crowd of people. There was a woman in her fur drape holding serving platters waiting to check out. So, Marianne, this is not new.
Do you collectors get together? Is there a club and you guys get together and talk about this stuff?
Well, there's not really a club. We know other collectors, and they will find things and call us and say, you know, this is what I found. Do you have one? I already do. Do you want this one?
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who share our passion for the history who don't collect that we talk to.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, Steve, what else did you bring to us you want to talk about?
I've got a couple of interesting things. Here's a little oval. It's a soft metal candy dish.
Mm-hmm.
And it is... It's embossed the new Union Station, Kansas City, Missouri. And what's interesting is this is a design concept graphic, not as it was built.
Ah.
We didn't know that there was supposed to be a glass barrel roof over both the north waiting room
the
main.
Right.
But what's interesting is, and these are, this would have been from about 1911, 12, because obviously it's before they actually built the building.
It. Right.
It looks kind of pretty. It's silver.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually made out of lead.
Really?
And because it's very, very cheap metal, easy to,
Is something like that worth anything?
Only to a collector.
Mm-hmm.
I actually, when I find them, it's probably a $10 or $15,
mm-hmm.
And I have them actually silver plated so that the graphic's much more obvious.
Yeah.
The lead over the years acquires a very dull patina.
Steve and Marianne Knoll are my guests. They are Kansas City history collectors extraordinaire. We're talking about some of their items. They've kindly brought a few of them here. Point to something else, Steve.
How about this? This is, I love the Alameda Hotel.
Mm-hmm. This has changed hands so many times.
It has, and it was originally opened by the Gilbert Robinson Restaurant Organization.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a plate from the Alameda Roof Restaurant, fine dining at its ultimate at the time. But what I think is fascinating about it is the colors. They are so 1972. The burnt orange, the faded gold, the brown graphic. That's what's interesting is because a lot of these artifacts capture the tastes of some fairly narrowly defined eras.
Mm-hmm.
This is a fun little artifact. This is a little trowel.
Trowel, yeah.
It's miniature. It couldn't actually be used as a trowel. It's got a beautiful wooden handle, and it's embossed Muncie Sand, Cream of the Caw. Which was their brand name. Now, it's and Muncie Sand was a major building materials. Here in Kansas City. And what's interesting, you have the cream of the caw. Well, I think we all accept that the caw ends at the Missouri River.
Mm-hmm.
But this is embossed Kansas City, Missouri, because that's where their headquarters were. But it's really a really cool little letter opener.
Mm. Do you guys do anything to protect all this stuff in terms of security, given the years and the effort you've put into this?
We live in Perfect Village. We don't have security problems.
Not in Perfect Village. It's not an issue over there. Yeah.
I mean, we keep the doors locked. Everything, dusting is a bigger detriment. So we've got most things in display cases that are covered so that the dust doesn't get in.
I forgot to ask. You just acquired a collection of 1 million photographs from a mortuary. How did the photographs wind up in the mortuary,
well,
Marianne?
The photographs we moved to the mortuary. The photographs were Chris Wilburn's photo collection.
I know Chris, yeah.
And he wanted to retire, and he wanted the negatives to stay in Kansas City. And we really felt like we wanted the negatives to stay in Kansas City. So we are donating those to the Jackson County Historical Society.
Ah, this is my retirement legacy.
Yes, yes.
And we bought the Steina McClure Mortuary Building, and where the negatives are being processed down there. So Chris had them in the caves on 31st Street. He wanted to get out of his lease, so we moved them there, and we're processing them to preserve them. Hopefully in the next year or so, we'll get them scanned and get them available on the internet so anybody can see them.
If people want to get a hold of you guys, they want to come see what you got, how can they connect with you?
Well, we have an email address, kccollects@gmail.com.
That'll probably get it done.
And, we'd love to hear from people. If we have people contact us, sometimes they want to sell us their collection. Sometimes they want to help put a value on it.
Sure.
And, but we're happy to talk with everybody. It's all about history.
Steve and Marianne Knoll, thank you for coming in and sharing your collection. What an interesting hobby you guys have. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Brian McTavish in your weekend to-do list.
When I go out with artists, they talk about language and the cubists and the daddies, and I try to catch their meanings and keep up with all of the martinis. I don't know which should be my favorite paint.
Look who's here. Brian McTavish will talk about some cool stuff to do this weekend. And you want to begin with the granddaddy of them all, the 86th annual Plaza Art Fair.
Where else?
Where else?
But there.
It's a big deal.
To begin.
It's a big deal.
This weekend, yes, it is. And I just want to say, wonderful, interesting, fascinating, collecting couple.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Two people.
You collect comic books.
Yeah.
They collect history.
They collect.
You have something in common.
It sounds like they collect everything else.
Yes.
I collect the comics. They've got the rest of it covered. But it's important, Steve, to keep the collection going.
Mm-hmm.
Got to keep it going. And that was really interesting on the drive-in listening. Wow.
Good.
Okay, on to other potential collectibles. Certainly wonderful, beautiful, pretty interesting things to peruse and perhaps purchase at the 86th Annual Plaza Art Fair. It's art, it's music, it's food, and yes, it's you. Friday evening, basically all day and night Saturday, and for the most part on Sunday. Where else but the beautiful Country Club Plaza?
Yeah.
Let's just go down. I mean, they're, okay, 2D and 3D mixed media, ceramics, digital stuff, drawings and pastels, fiberglass, jewelry, metalwork, paintings.
And KCUR has a booth.
That's right.
I'll be there Saturday night. Come by and say hello.
Fantastic. Yeah. Will you be perusing for perhaps a print or a sculpture or something while you're there?
Yeah. I always do.
Something. What's over the mantle now?
A French impressionist painting from Degas.
Ah, yes. No, well, what else would you have?
I'm joking.
Here's a big, if crass, seller, a suggestion. It might be a children's stroller adornment. If you were an artist, because there's going to be a jillion children's kiddie strollers there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So just imagine if you could add some punch or some pizzazz to like a little toy.
You're
that
always thinking.
Suction cupped on the stroller. You could sell a lifetime supply, I'm sure.
I ain't happy. I'm feeling glad I got sunshine. In a bag, I'm useless. But not for long, the future is coming on. I ain't happy, I'm feeling glad I got sunshine. In a bag, I'm useless. But not for long, the future is
talk to me.
Okay, talk to me. Okay, so what we're listening to sounds like human beings making music, right? And I guess they are, and we're going to find out for sure just who the humans are in Gorillaz, with a Z at the end, at 7:30 Friday night at Sprint Center. But for the last 15-plus years, the visual hook for this English rock and hip-hop band, Gorillaz, has been that the so-called members, Steve, are four cartoon characters. Creepy, weird, zany-looking characters playing the instruments in various videos. Their names, virtually speaking, are 2D,
Murdoch Nichols, Noodle, and Russell Hobbs. Totally fictional, but the real people behind it, the collaborators behind it, it's English singer-songwriter Damon Albarn. And around 1999, he got together with comic book artist Jamie Hewlett, and they came up with this fantastic concept where, kind of like the Archies. Remember the Archies in the late 60s and early 70s? Gosh, we're old. And they had these hits. It was a fake band. Now, this is a real band with a fake front. It's complicated, all this pop culture conundrum material.
But they're here. Friday night.
Sprint Center. Go have a great cartoony time with these guys.
Be sure to see Brian's six artistic things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org.
She don't give a damn about your Benjamin Franklins. She wants Aretha. She don't really care how you're spending your money. It's all how you treat her. She just wants a friend to be there when she opens her eyes in the morning.
America's best-looking couple, they're going to be here, too.
They sure are.
The next night at Sprint Center.
Oh, yeah.
Saturday night.
Yeah, right. So you've got Gorillaz Friday at Sprint, and then Saturday night, you've got Tim McGraw and his wife, Faith Hill. And that's Faith singing the lead vocal on a recent single of theirs called Speak to a Girl, which has some great advice, right? She don't give a damn about your Benjamin Franklins. She wants Aretha, which means she wants R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Get that, guys?
Sure.
You listening out there, guys?
Yeah.
I'm listening.
Yeah.
So the country music superstars take their continuing marital bliss on the road. They've been married for 21 years. It's a 7:30 show Saturday night at Sprint Center. Let me just share this with you. Today is Faith Hill's 50th birthday.
Wow.
And her
Happy birthday,
Faith, and I'm sure you're listening. But anyway, Tim McGraw's Instagram birthday wish today said, among other loving things, "You are the most remarkable person that has ever been in my life. Our daughters could not have a better role model. I am truly in love with you more every day. Can't wait to see what the rest of our life has in store for us." Well, Tim, how about a concert with your wife in Kansas City on Saturday night?
You're bringing tears to my eyes.
Oh, gosh. Here's a tissue.
And for a very different kind of weekend possibility.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's an arty weekend for sure, right? Mm-hmm. And that includes, I guess every day, it includes the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art.
Just walk over there from the plaza.
Yeah, we could walk there from here.
Mm-hmm.
I would need a bottle of water. You not so much because you're in shape. But, okay, 10 to 4 on Sunday at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, outside, inside. Part of the experience, one day only this year, is the American Indian Cultural Celebration, in which Native Americans will dance, make music, show art, tell stories. There'll be games and demonstrations for kids, teepee making. The Haskell Indian Nation's university dancers will be there, and they represent more than 150 Native cultures. That's part of the student body of Haskell Indian Nation's U in Lawrence, Kansas.
Great pick.
Great pick, great time, go get them. I'm in love with my car. Got a feel for my automobile. Get a grip on my boy racer
robot. Such a thrill when your radio's smooth. If you don't like traditional art, you can go look at cars.
Be careful now.
Cars.
Car lovers might...
They might say their cars are...
Cars are art, case closed.
Right. Yes.
Now, I've crossed a few finish lines in my time, driving my wheels, but I've never had a car I could love. I never loved a car. Have you loved a car?
I have not.
Okay, we got to work on that, pal. Yes. Anyway, it's the KCI Cruise specialty car event. It's at the Ambassador Building or around it. It's near the Kansas City International Airport. Last year, they had 900. Hopefully more this year. Classic cars, muscle cars, heart rods. Did I say heart rods?
I think so.
If you love them, they're your heart rod. I think I should trademark that. And other exotic autos aplenty will be on display, ultimately for charity. It's free to get in from 3 to dark on Saturday, but buy a $1 raffle ticket and win an autographed Chiefs football. Alex Smith will autograph it for
you. That's the tall one, Brian McTavish, with your weekend to-do list. Thanks, man.
Oh, thank you.
Tomorrow on the show, Melissa Etheridge will be here, and we'll discuss the legacy of Kansas City icon Marjorie Powell Allen. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Justin Garnett produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske. and you are up to date.